It was about 16 months ago, May 4th of last year. Two young missionaries, Ann Summer and her roommate Claudia, had come together in their apartment about 8:30 in the evening, and they were having tea when the doorbell rang in their apartment in a city in Central Asia. Claudia was closest to the front entryway, and so she rose and went to the door. And through the door, she heard a woman's voice asking if she could use the telephone. That was fairly common in their apartment building. The next thing that Anne heard was Claudia scream. Anne quickly rose and ran into the entryway, and as she did, she was met by a man who hit her in the face and then in the head, pulled a gun and began to hit her with it until he knocked her to the floor, and then he kicked her into stillness. At that, the man left her and began rummaging through the apartment. Anne rose from the floor and staggered into the entryway, where she found the other man taping Claudia to a chair. She attacked that man and at the same time tried to free Claudia, and together the two of them attacked the man, but he overpowered them and continued to hit them until both of them were back on the floor again. But surprisingly, he left them to join the other man in ransacking the apartment. Badly cut and bleeding and in a great deal of pain, Anne and Claudia managed to get out of that entryway and into yet another room whose door they closed and then barricaded with a piece of furniture and their backs against that piece of furniture as they began to scream for help and kicked their heels on the floor as hard as they could, hoping to attract the attention of the neighbors below. They continued to scream and to kick for some 20 minutes while the two men stayed in the apartment and would continually come to the door and threaten them and so forth. And they would continue to, that is, the women would continue to bang on the floor until finally they heard sirens of the police vehicles. And in just a few moments, they heard the policemen ask them to come out of their barricaded room. Saliha and Sattar, the downstairs neighbors, had every reason to disregard Anne and Claudia. For 3 weeks earlier, Saliha and Sattar had finally put together the money to wallpaper for the first time their apartment. But just 3 days after they had wallpapered it, Anne unfortunately accidentally let the water run in her kitchen, and it ran down into the apartment beneath and ruined all of their newly papered walls. Now, 3 weeks later, Saliha and Sattar decided that this night, though they normally worked the evening shift, they would take the time off and re-wallpaper their apartment. God's providence, in God's providence, those two people were in their apartment that night when above them, Anne and Claudia were crying for help. It was 2 weeks later, after their somewhat of recovery, that Anne and Claudia moved back into their apartment. And Anne writes these words: "Instead of allowing me to be fearful, God has caused my mind to dwell on His hand in the matter. As I think of the attack, I have such a clear picture of God saying, 'The line is drawn here, this far, no farther.' I remember the peace He gave me during those 20 minutes. I understand in a new way His protection, His grace, and His tenderness. I have experiential knowledge of God as my refuge and strength, a very close or present help in trouble." Again, I ask you, have you ever been truly afraid? The airplane suddenly drops several hundred feet, and as your stomach jumps into your throat, your pulse quickens. What are you afraid of? Death? Dying? But not all fears are from imminent physical threat. In fact, many fears are much less overt, much more subtle. A Wall Street Journal article several years ago surveyed people to discover what they were most afraid of, and surprisingly, death was not number one. Numbers 1 and 2 were the fear of failure and the fear of loneliness. Just a couple of years ago, USA Today ran an article on people's greatest fears. 53% of people fearing cancer, 50% fearing inadequate Social Security, 49% fearing not having enough money for retirement, 35% of getting Alzheimer's, 32% of not being able to pay their bills, 23% of losing a job. Fears come in all sizes and shapes. Psychologist Eric Erickson, in his book Childhood and Society, describes the various phases of social development of the human being. I have paraphrased them somewhat, but he describes the crisis that a person must go through, in a sense, in each stage. In early childhood and infancy, or infancy, early childhood, there's the fear of abandonment. It is overcome by knowing that someone is there to take care of me. In school age, it's the fear of inferiority. It's overcome when they begin to learn that they are able to do things. There's the fear of rejection in adolescence, and then having it overcome by the knowledge that we are accepted. In young adulthood, it's the fear of isolation, that fear of never truly belonging, and it's overcome when you truly know intimacy and a closeness to someone else. In adulthood, it's the fear of failure. In maturity, it's the fear of uselessness or dying. Those are real fears, and obtuse is the person who does not know that they have experienced one or more of those fears in their lives. Fear is a natural and spontaneous response to a very real threat. It is not wrong to have fear. The issue is, how do we respond to fear? For the Christian, we are invited to have faith in the face of fear. Faith is not the absence of fear, but faith is the proper response to it. You don't know faith until you've known fear. Trust is unnecessary if you've never known fear. Alexander McLaren wrote it this way: fear is the occasion of faith, and faith is fear transformed. The question is, how do you respond to fear? Do you respond in faith to God? So the cluster of issues that I wish to speak to this morning are these: fear and faith and God's protection. Those three issues, and how do they relate to one another? Fear and faith and God's protection. We sometimes blithely, carelessly claim that we have no fear because we are trusting in God's protection. We sometimes think that we ought not to fear because we ought to be trusting in God's protection. We tell our child, however, that they can now go safely alone to school because God will protect them. What do we mean when we say that? What do they think we mean when we say that? And how do we and she respond when she hears of a little Christian friend of hers who gets injured on the way to school? Did God not protect her? And will God not protect me? What do we mean when we say that God is our protector? And what do we expect from God's protection? You know, the mortality rate is the same for Christians as non-Christians. The same percentage of Christians as non-Christians dies prematurely from certain diseases. Except for maybe alcohol-related incidents, I suspect as high a percentage of Christians as non-Christians dies in automobile accidents. I further suspect that the same percentage of Christians as non-Christians died in World War II and any other war that our country has fought. Did those Christians or their families fail to pray for protection? Did God fail to protect them? We ask God to intervene in our circumstances, the circumstances that threaten our income, that threaten our health, that threaten our relationships, that threaten our very lives. What do we expect? How do we respond in the face of fear? And what is the role of faith and God's role in all of it? In Genesis chapter 31, the man Jacob, whom we've been looking at most recently, finally determines that he is going to return to his homeland from which he had gone some 20 years earlier. 20 years earlier, he had fled from his hometown because his brother was threatening to kill him for all the things that Jacob had done. Now it's 20 years later, and surprisingly, Jacob is in something of the same predicament. During a lot of years of hard work, Jacob had acquired a large family, 12 kids. He had also acquired a great deal of wealth. But when we pick up the story, Jacob is again a man in fear, and he is running in fear. Jacob's father-in-law, Laban, had cheated Jacob at every turn, and Laban had become rich at Jacob's expense. Jacob had worked for him for 14 years to gain the right to marry his daughters. He'd worked for him then during all of those 14 years, and during it, every time Jacob would do something prosperous and right, Laban is the one who would get the wealth. It had always been Jacob's intention to leave that place where he was then living and go back to his home country. But now everything was right for him to do so, because in the last 6 years, contrary to the preceding 14, God had intervened and Jacob was becoming a wealthy man. He had his family, he had the prosperity he needed, and he was ready to go. So in chapter 31, we pick up the story that Jacob is beginning to hear threatening scuttlebutt about Laban's sons, and also hearing some very disturbing things about Laban himself and Laban's attitude. It seems that the brothers-in-law are building a case against Jacob. They look at what has happened over the last 20 years, particularly the last 6 years, and they think to themselves, not unwisely, that Jacob is gaining in wealth as our father, who has our inheritance, is decreasing in wealth. Even Laban himself has a change of attitude toward Jacob. Now, Jacob assumes that it's only a matter of time. Only a matter of time before those people take some kind of action. Having succeeded in no other way, would the brothers, in fact, rise up and take everything from Jacob? Furthermore, since Laban's attitude is changing, is there a chance that Laban himself will try to intervene and keep Jacob's family from being able to go with Jacob as he leaves? Sensing a very real threat, Jacob pulled his wives aside and very carefully built a case for leaving. You see, a very real fear existed also in Jacob, I think, that his wives may not want to leave their father, their mother, their brothers, their larger family, and all that they had known all of their lives. But having witnessed what they had of Laban's unfair dealings with their husband, having themselves come to understand that their father did not care for them in the way that they wished that he would have, and having seen God's hand at bringing both a family and prosperity to their family, they agreed with Jacob that they should leave. So Jacob waited for the opportune time to leave. That is, he waited for a time when Laban would be 3 days away shearing his sheep. And in case they needed to make a run for it, Jacob put his family members on the faster-moving camels, and then with as much stealth as is possible, leading thousands of head of cattle, they sneaked out of the country. 3 days later, Laban heard that they had gone. He gathered his men together, and he began the chase after Jacob and his family. And 7 days later, Laban finally caught up with Jacob. Now, I've seen enough of the old westerns on television to have some sense of what that scene might have been like as Laban positions himself so that Jacob cannot make any further escape. And then the encounter is about to happen. Now, if Jacob had been fearful earlier, at the time that he was ready to escape, imagine his fear now as he anticipates what Laban is about to do. But before we look at what happens there, I want you to see the next incident in Jacob's life, for I think it speaks to the same issue. Now, I obviously give away the ending of the first story by telling you that there is a second story, but in fact, the next time, the situation is even more threatening. For in the next situation, in chapters 32 and 33, Jacob's very life is on the line. Jacob was heading home. And home meant a brother who had every intention of killing him and had threatened to do so. It may be 20 years later, but the threat is just as real. What Jacob had done to his older brother 20 years earlier still stands. He's threatened. Now, knowing that very real danger that lies ahead, or lays ahead, Jacob sent messengers to go down to where he knew Esau lived. And he sent the messengers down there with very explicit instructions that the messengers are to say, "Your servant Jacob wishes to give these gifts to his lord Esau," in hopes that somehow through these gifts Esau's anger could be mitigated. The response that Jacob got, however, when the messengers came back to report was simply this: "Esau is on his way with 400 men. At that, our text says this: "In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and the herds and the camels as well. And he thought, if Esau comes and attacks one group, the group that is left may escape." And after a night like no other night he had ever experienced, which we're going to look at next week, we read this: "Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men." Now, if the threat from Laban was real, imagine the threat that Jacob must have felt at that point in time, with those men probably on camels or horses, as fierce as people in those days could look, as those people approached his camp. So what does Jacob do? What has he been doing with that fear that he has regarding his brother Esau? And what does God do? Now, throughout my study of these two stories, which I see as quite similar, and I think are juxtaposed for the purposes that we will describe later, as I was studying these two stories, I began to ask myself about Jacob. What is this man? Is this man a faithless schemer who is depending more on his own ingenuity than on God's intervention? Or do we have here a picture of a faithful man who is acting shrewdly in something similar to the way that Jesus commended when Jesus said we are to be wise as serpents? Are his then the actions of a faithless man, or are they the actions of a faithful man? And as I pondered that, it occurred to me that it could be both. Maybe what we have here is that Jacob, like me and maybe like you, found himself in the terrible tension of both believing and not believing at the same time. Maybe Jacob found himself in that place where he was calling out to God, but he wasn't absolutely certain that God would do what was necessary. He found himself in the place of trusting God, but not fully trusting God. I think what Jacob experiences in spite of his actions is that God is there. And what these stories are going to demonstrate is that in spite of Jacob's great faith or lack of faith, in spite of Jacob's ingenuity or lack thereof, God was there, and God was controlling circumstances for Jacob's good. But hear this: for Jacob's good according to God's purposes and plans for Jacob. God was giving to Jacob two more experiences from which Jacob and his descendants would learn that they can trust God in every circumstance of life, no matter how threatening it is. These two stories teach us that God is in gracious control of our lives, and God will allow into our lives only those things that will result in our ultimate good, so that slowly, possibly, but hopefully surely, we will learn to trust him, that he truly is there in every situation. Now, in both of these stories, I see the same four elements. Number one, Jacob experiences fear, and it's real fear. Secondly, I see that Jacob responds to God. Thirdly, I see that Jacob plans very shrewdly. And fourthly, Jacob experiences God's gracious intervention. Now, in the first of the two stories, in the one where Jacob is fleeing from his father-in-law Laban, first of all, know that Jacob experienced real fear regarding his own livelihood and even the possibility of having his own family to take with him back to his homeland. But Jacob responds to God. God had told him to go. And even though it was a risky situation, Jacob responded in obedience, and he makes a plan. Now, what I find interesting is that Jacob is neither paralyzed by fear, nor is he complacent in faith. If he'd been paralyzed by fear, he would have done nothing about obeying God. If he had been complacent in faith, he might have been so rash as to announce his leaving to Laban. Again, I think about Jacob and I wonder, which is it here? Is it that he had great faith? Or is it that he was faithless that he makes the plans that he makes? And again, I think maybe it's both. He trusts God, but he's not quite sure how far to trust God. He knows he ought to obey God and leave, but he also makes plans for doing so that are somewhat deceptive. And I'm not certain, frankly, whether to count Jacob's actions as sinful or faithful. But he acts, and he acts shrewdly. But his plan is not sufficient. It doesn't take very long, 7 days actually, 10 days I guess. 10 days, and Jacob learns that for all of his planning, for all of his sneaking away, he is still at Laban's mercy. But what he truly learns is that he's at God's mercy. When Laban finally comes into the camp with his relatives, and he has all the ability in the world to, in fact, defeat Jacob at that point in time, to take him out of the picture and take all of that wealth back to Laban's home. The text says Laban knows he has that power. Jacob knows Laban has that power. And after Laban threatens Jacob, then Laban admits that God had come to Laban in a dream at night and had told Laban, "Don't harm Jacob." Jacob learns that God has intervened, that God was there through it all. Now, in the second of the two stories, where Jacob anticipates his meeting with Esau, we see the same four elements. First of all, there is a very real threat on his life and the lives of the members of his family. Secondly, Jacob responds to God by praying, and what a prayer it is. Most notably in the prayer, besides acknowledging to God that Jacob is unworthy, what Jacob does is he lays claim to God's promises. He begins his prayer that way, and he ends his prayer that way. In other words, he's not coming to God saying, "God, you ought to do all these things because I need this and this and this, or because I deserve this, or because I want this." He comes to God in prayer and says, "God, you have to do this because you said you would." He lays claim to God's promises, not just to his own desires. Thirdly, Jacob acts shrewdly. He sets up a rather elaborate scheme. That is, he divides many of, if not all of his cattle, all of his belongings, into four groups, large groups. And he sends these groups out one after another, asking his servants to keep distance between the groups, so that as one group after another comes, Maybe Esau, in getting this incredible gift, and then the next gift, and then the next one, and the next one, maybe his anger would be assuaged, mitigated, and he would come to Jacob by having changed his intentions. But fourthly, what Jacob experiences is the intervention of God. When Esau and his 400 men finally show up, Jacob learns that Esau has rejected all four of those massive gifts. What next? Jacob, it says in the text, gets down, runs to Jacob, Esau gets down, runs to Jacob, embraces him, and weeps. And the reconciliation is complete. Having refused all of the gifts, with nothing else having changed in those 20 years from when it was that Jacob had so grievously sinned against his older brother, what happened? God changed Esau's heart. Jacob is absolutely confident of it. Now, what's the lesson that Jacob and his descendants would learn through it all? What's the lesson for us? Is God promising to protect us from every negative kind of experience in life? God's promise to Jacob, reiterated over and over again, was that God would be with Jacob everywhere he went and through every experience of life, and that God would make certain that God's good purposes for Jacob would be fulfilled. The point of the story is not that Jacob escaped death at the hands of Laban and Esau. The point of the story is that God was with Jacob, actively intervening and controlling to accomplish God's purposes in Jacob's life. If you remember the stories of Jacob that follow this at all, then you know that Jacob would yet experience many very difficult, even tragic situations in his life. The stories do not teach that God would keep Jacob out of those tragic circumstances. The stories teach that God would keep him even in those circumstances, and that God would be with him. John Calvin wrote it this way: "For God does not promise that he will be present with us for the purpose of removing the sense of our dangers, but in order that fear may not prevail and may not overwhelm us in despair." So what does God's protection mean? It means that he will steadfastly refuse to allow anything to come into our lives that does not come with his permission. And with everything that he does allow into our lives, he himself comes to walk with us through it. For he has promised, his word declares it, he will never leave us or forsake us. Now some would say, that's a foolish faith. What does that kind of faith, what kind does that intervention by God accomplish? For it makes no difference in the end, we all die. We would say it makes all the difference in the world, in at least three ways. When threatened with the loss of life, as we all eventually are, we do not despair, because we know that this life is not all there is. Folks, I have seen that, and I hope some of you have seen that in the experience of others. It makes all the difference in the world. Secondly, we do not fear what may come after this life, for we know that our God will be there too, and we will be with him. Thirdly, as Jacob's experience teaches us, we know that even in the fears of this life, our God is with us every step of the way. An old story tells of a woman who was deathly afraid in a violent storm. She asked her husband why he was not as afraid as she was. Odd as the story sounds, he took a knife and he held it to her throat and asked her if she was afraid. She said, no. He said, why aren't you afraid? She said, because the knife is in your hand. He said, so it is with the storm. It and we are in God's hands. 2 months ago, one of our elders, Tom Bayless, witnessed what to me is one of the most powerful demonstrations of the kind of faith experience that we are describing here. That kind of faith experience where you know the presence of God despite awful circumstances. Several of us had gone to Kremlin, Colorado to wait with former members Aldo and Sharon Claussen as they waited in turn for knowledge about their son who the day before had capsized in a kayaking accident. When word came that his body had been found, confirming their worst fears, the father, Aldo, had to be alone. And not aware that anybody else saw him, with the kind of grief that I think can only be imagined, raised his hands into the heavens and cried out, "My son, my son." Again, not aware that anybody observed this, almost unbelievably, he added these words, "The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In that moment, Tom and the rest of us vicariously witnessed the most awesome demonstration of the presence of God. For I believe with everything within me that no man could say those words under those circumstances unless God was there with him. affirming to his mind and to the depths of his heart. But this was not the end of the story. God was there. We witnessed it. God calls us not to faith in certain happy endings. God calls us to faith in him. He will not forsake us. He will never leave us. Bow with me.